This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, we lost a visionary leader last week. People from around the world mourn the death of Steve Jobs, Apple co-founder, who died from complications with pancreatic cancer at the age of 56.
Well, Mark, he was a true visionary and died too young. As so many have said, he imagined tools and products that make life more fun, more interesting, more rich, even before we knew we wanted those products. And it felt like the world really recognized this loss across the globe. Very unusual for the head of a corporation to elicit such emotion and sorrow when they pass.
It really did. Within an hour of the news of his death, people were posting testimonials and homemade obits on Twitter and Facebook. There were shrines at Apple stores outside his Palo Alto home. Lots of them included clever visuals incorporating Apple themes and products.
Well, his legacy lives on. And in the world of health reform and its legacy, last week there was a new development, a step that moves the federal government closer to defining what is an essential benefit. Really the first time that this has been attempted at a federal level, and this is in the health insurance exchange programs that will offer coverage in 2014.
That's right. The Institute of Medicine released their report that outlines how the Department of Health and Human Services should develop these benefits. It didn't tell the administration which types of benefits should be included in plans, but how to define the minimum benefits. Overall, the report urged HHS to weigh cost in deciding essential health benefits.
Yeah, and cost is one consideration, but not all of it. It also said that the federal government should allow those states that administer their own health insurance exchange, which I think is actually going to be most of them, to be able to make changes on that list of essential benefits as long as they're consistent with the guiding principles of the Affordable Care Act, which is about prevention and also comprehensive benefits. And I think this is especially important because the state of the science changes and evolves all the time around effective treatment and screening and diagnostic tests.
And those rules are expected to come out sometime next year. So more on that to come in the future. Turning to our today's guest, we are joined today by social media expert Lee Assay. Lee is the director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Social Media. We're happy he can be with us today to share some thoughts about engaging patients and providers and improving patient satisfaction through social media.
And no matter what the story, you can always find all of our shows and hear more about us by Googling CHC Radio.
As always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Lee Assay, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. Healthy People 2010, a national initiative to improve the health of all Americans, hasn't lived up to its goals. Experts conducting a final review of the results found that minority and low-income groups continue to be less likely to have a regular source of health care when compared to the general population. Although there have been efforts over the past decade to remedy the situation, this and other health disparities persist across race, ethnicity, income level, and education. On a more positive note, progress has been made in other areas. Life expectancy at birth went up a year, from 76.8 years in 2000 to 77.8 years in 2007. And rates of death from coronary heart disease, stroke, and other illness decreased over the course of the decade. But health disparities remain a major problem. The U.S. Preventive Task Force, the federal panel that regularly assesses preventive medical care, downgraded its recommendation for PSA testing for prostate cancer. The 16-member panel says that most men should not routinely get the blood test to check for prostate cancer because the exam does not save lives. Instead, it leads to unnecessary anxiety, surgery, and complications. In other words, the evidence concludes that the risks appeared to outweigh the benefits for those who are showing no signs of the disease. Although the recommendation is likely to create controversy, the influence of the panel's recommendations are being enhanced by the new federal healthcare law, which will base some of its requirements on the group's ratings.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Lee Assay, director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Social Media, a first-of-its-kind social media center focused on healthcare. Welcome, Lee.
Hi, glad to be with you.
I know many of our listeners have heard of Mayo Clinic, and it's known as being a leader in healthcare in the country. And many people from around the world travel to your locations in Minnesota, Florida, Arizona for treatment. What people might not know is that Mayo Clinic was one of its first to use social media to empower patients and cut red tape that gets in the way of treatment innovations. Lee, was there a moment when you realized that your website was changing the experience patients were having in receiving their health care?
Well, I think, there have been a few little milestones along the way. I think when we did our first podcast in 2005, we used it as a way of delivering the audio files that we already had on our website, but in a more, on a subscription basis. We had these video audio files on our website already, and we're averaging about 900 downloads a month. And in the first month of our podcast, we got featured in the iTunes podcast directory, and we saw our downloads go from the 900 a month to 74,000 in a month.
Wow.
Which just kind of got our attention. So that was an early signpost, I guess, along the way. I think what we've seen is a gradual evolution since then, where we just look for new applications for ways to provide more in-depth information to patients. And we've definitely had some, excellent stories come out of that, where, people have told us that they found a 10-minute YouTube video that really explained, a condition, a really rare condition that they have in a way that was helpful to them. And ended up coming, thousands of miles here to be seen.
So, Lee, many different technologies, of course, come under the umbrella of social media, from podcasts, as you referenced, to YouTube videos, blogs, Twitter, Facebook. And we've tended up until now to talk about using these as vehicles for us to push information out there, push stories, push healthcare information out. But equally important seems that patients are beginning to use the technologies to tell their stories, which we then can share with other people. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Mayo is doing to engage patients in telling their stories that can then be shared with other patients?
Well, sure. One of the things that probably our flagship blog is the one called Sharing Mayo Clinic, which is a blog that we launched in January of 2009 as a way for patients to share their experiences with others, to tell their stories, and also for our Mayo employees to tell stories about why they appreciate working at Mayo and why they believe in their work and why they enjoy it. And so that's one key way. And so either through the comments on the blog or by sending us a story that they ask us to post for them, we enable that. But just in July of this year, we created our Mayo Clinic network for patients. It's at connect.mayoclinic.org. And as of right now, I think we have about 7,100 people who've joined that. And this is much more of a Facebook kind of experience, only not on Facebook, a place where people can have an identity that's either theirs, for full first name, last name, or else it can be they can use a screen name if they want some additional privacy, but they can talk about, they can discuss their stories. They can discuss and ask questions. And so it's been, that's the next step in making a more highly interactive environment.
Lee, at the Community Health Center here in Connecticut, we're very proud of our residency programs. We have a couple of them. One was the first family nurse practitioner program in America, and now we're just opening up a postdoc in psychology residency. But you, my friend, at the Mayo Clinic are kicking off a social media residency this month. Can you tell us more about this initiative and what led you to establish it?
The 17th, 18th, and 19th, we're holding a three-day conference that we're producing in conjunction with Reagan Communications that is sort of your traditional, conference where you hear presentations from mm-hmm. people who are doing interesting things. Then we have our member meeting for the Social Media Health Network. But what we're doing at the end of the week is instead of, kind of the week-long boot camp, what we're calling the last 2 days is social media residency. And we're, instead of using the military boot camp metaphor, we're saying, let's do it like medicine. I mean, we're going to have residency. We have chief residents. We have matching, you know, like match day that you do for residency. And then also, you know, we have it going, you know, kind of late into the evening. I mean, they'll be probably wrapping up around 10 or 10:30 Thursday night and up at 8 o'clock the next morning and at it again. But a chance to have a much more hands-on, interactive, small group kind of experience. So we're limiting it to no more than 80 participants for that, and we'll have at least one chief resident or, you know, experienced person per table of eight, so that it'll be not just the beginners kind of how do you get started with things, but much more more advanced, just as medical residency is more advanced than medical school. This is that, you know, context of how do you apply this and how do you think strategically about using these tools in an organization.
So, Lee, the richness of learning and support that patients derive from social media technologies, especially when organized in a system like yours, is pretty obvious, but it also seems that it offers enormous benefits for learning to providers, clinicians, healthcare professionals as well. You know, we hear all the time, we've said oftentimes that the length of time between the discovery of a better way to do things and the actual implementation and practice is 16 or 17 years. And I've heard it said that social media has the potential to shorten that gap considerably, to get that information out sooner, more widely spread, tested, and adopted. What's your experience been at the Mayo? Presumably you have all of the specialists who could just turn to each other, but are they also learning from people around the globe and sharing with people around the globe new best practices?
Well, certainly, and that's, I mean, we've got a case study that is an example of how that can happen, and it does come based on a discovery here at Mayo Clinic of a kind of wrist tear, ligament tear that one of our orthopedic surgeons discovered back around 2001 or so, and you know, it's kind of a long story, but what it comes down to is that through some of the social media platforms, being able to, and then telling the story through social, you know, through our mainstream media as well, and how those have interacted between the social and the mainstream media. He sent me an email last year talking about how he had been invited to present at a plenary session of the American Society for Surgery of the Hand, and he specifically said, you know, social media has driven this into practices in less than 2 years when it takes 17 years on average. You know, that he's able to connect much more. And it's also harnessing the patients who have the condition and enabling them to help spread the word as well. So it is, I mean, I think we're so early in this in terms of realizing the potential, but that's why we have a Center for Social Media and why we're going to be naming a new medical director in the next within the next month, because we want to have a physician with dedicated time to be able to help us explore how these tools can be used, not just kind of in the PR marketing realm, and as you said, as pushing out information, but how it can help medical research and education, both patient education and medical education and CME, and as well as research. So, and then being also applied in improving the clinical practice. So we're excited at how things are developing.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Lee Acey, Director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Social Media. Lee, many providers and healthcare institutions are reluctant to use social media. I guess that's sort of a euphemism for saying that the battle lines are drawn within organizations. Those who are trying to protect the organization in the name of patient privacy and network security. And on the other side, 500 million people on Facebook sharing very personal information and very comfortable tweeting, texting all of the time. That's a pretty large divide. How have you managed the conflict at Mayo Clinic? And can you give some advice to organizations out there who are trying to figure out how to bring those two sides together?
Sure. Well, one thing I would emphasize is, you know, is the continuity between the way people have, you know, interacted for generations, for centuries, for millennia. I mean, that it's all been word of mouth. It's been about, and these electronic tools just make that word of mouth spread further and faster. I think the point that I emphasize with those who are reluctant to be involved in these social platforms is that whether you're involved or not, the rest of the world is. Mm-hmm. And that if you just Google your name or Google your organization's name, you may not like what you see. And part of the reason you might not like what you see is because you haven't put anything out there in these spaces that enables people you know, to react to it. I know that one of our national peers, if you were to Google or go onto YouTube and search for Cleveland Clinic back 4 or 5 years ago, what you would see was a video, was a series of videos by a disgruntled patient mm-hmm. that showed up on the first page of results. The way to resolve that is to put up some videos of your own, so that then when people are searching for your organization's name, they'll see it. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that, you know, patients are thirsty for information. Actually, nobody cares about healthcare till they get sick. Mm-hmm. But once they get sick, then they are sponges and they want to find out everything they can, and they gravitate online and they're going to go there. And so it's really an ethical and moral obligation from our perspective that you have qualified medical voices, you know, participating in those conversations too.
And I guess that would lead into something I've been thinking about relative to your work, which is that there are thousands, probably tens of thousands, apps to engage with your health, websites to learn about your condition, online chat rooms and support groups for people who have various issues. And it would seem the Mayo Clinic, like the Cleveland, like we'd like to think our community health center, is a bit of a good housekeeping seal of approval, mm-hmm. right? The imprimatur that this must be reliable information. So maybe you could just share with us a little bit, as other organizations, large and small, are thinking about going down this path. What's the organized structure for vetting, for deciding really what content goes up, for involving consumers in helping you think about what information is understandable and important to them? Maybe you could share some of that structure with us.
Well, sure. A big part of what we're doing is providing information, you know, video interviews, for instance, with subject experts who have, you know, subspecialty expertise. And so they're talking about, you know, an area in which they're really well-versed, and really it's their particular area of focus. So it's not just a specialist, but a subspecialist. And, you know, what we found with that is that, you know, the bar for creating content is much lower than it used to be, that because you have the consumer-grade video cameras that shoot HD, you can actually produce something that's pretty nice without a lot of expense. And so part of what we do is we look at what the interests of the, you know, researchers are, what the interests of the physicians are that are willing to, you know, be out there talking about their particular condition. And, you know, as I mentioned before, people don't care about health until they get sick. And so it really is a matter of being able to produce a lot of content that is, you know, and then you sort of find out where it goes from there. I mean, as people comment on it, as people share it, then the content that is of the most interest finds the people who are interested in it. One of our best examples is a video on myelofibrosis that is 10 and a half minutes, and it's, you know, Dr. Ruben Mesa from our Arizona campus talking about this. It wasn't like we did a focus group about what disease would you like to hear about. What we said was, you know, he had this passion for wanting to be able to communicate about myeloproliferative diseases. But interestingly, then online groups that are already out there, support groups that have formed around these diseases, somebody found the video and posted it within their network, and it's got more than 10,000 views now. And that's something that, you know, so as I said, it wasn't a, you know, we're going to go review our top, you know, marketing priorities or our top, you know, not going to create a a focus group to determine what videos would be most interesting. If we have the most important thing, I think, is the provider, the physician passion for the topic, and that what they're able to do now is to connect with other people who shared that same interest in a way that was previously impossible.
That's kind of interesting. It's sort of good storytelling, which has a long tradition of how one shares news. History creates lore is now, I would sort of substitute it with the word video that you had. And it's really about telling good stories. And so how do organizations think about telling those good stories? It's not always the case that you can just put somebody in front of a video and voila, you'll have some miraculous response from the public. And this is of particular concern to you because Mayo's known as an institution that treats rare conditions. And so you really want to reach out effectively to that broad population. So what coaching are you doing on the side, or how are you creating that ambiance of storytelling?
Well, a big part of it is to not be too produced. So I think to the extent that a story, a video seems slick, it probably is counterproductive. It's counterproductive in two ways. It costs more to do that. And then secondly, you know, it doesn't seem as genuine and authentic. I think what we do with our physicians is we ask them to pretend they're talking to somebody in the office who you've just diagnosed with this condition, or you're trying to provide an overview, you know, for, you know, an interested family member. And I think we do look for physicians who have that passion, have that ability to tell a story. But, you know, we do have training that we can, and coaching that we do with this. But part of it is just honed through, you know, seeing lots of patients and having to have those interactions. And it does provide, you know, through the consumer grade camera, does provide a real window into what the experience is like. In fact, we've had patients come, you know, to our, you know, physicians and say, "Wow, you're just like on your video," you know, which is exactly what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. Is that you know, that for 100 years people have had an experience at Mayo Clinic and gone home and told their family and friends, and that word of mouth has been, you know, really important. This is a way for people to get, you know, a direct peek into that experience, because it really is all about that doctor-patient relationship. Mm-hmm. and how they interact.
Lee, we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Besides
keeping an eye on you.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course, yeah. So, I mean, I just had a really, you know, was able to attend the Medicine 2.0 conference at Stanford just a week and a half or so ago, and heard some great presentations there. I think Bertalan Mesko, who goes by the Twitter handle Berci, Berci, is doing some really great things with a platform called Webacina, I think. But Berci is a physician who's going for a PhD in genomics, I think, and he's creating an online platform, curated platform that I think now is in about 18 languages for sharing medical information. I think he's doing some really interesting stuff there, and his whole idea is to make things available for free for everyone. And you know, being in 18 languages already, I think, is pretty amazing.
Great. We will follow up on that one. Today, we've been speaking with Lee Acey, director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Social Media. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Glad to be with you. Thanks so much.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea is about a preventative approach to emergency care. In cities across the country, community paramedics are now making home visits to elders and chronically ill patients in an effort to reduce 911 calls, emergencies, and hospital admissions. Around 40 million 911 calls are placed each year in the United States. By bringing paramedics to high-risk persons on a preventive basis, the thought is that some of these emergencies can be prevented. In a 15-city area centered in Fort Worth, Texas, for example, 21 people accounted for more than 1% of the total 911 call volume. So in 2009, paramedics went out into the community to visit these people and see if they could change that. More than 1,000 calls a year were cut, with substantial savings to the system. The push for more community paramedics is fueled in part by a cash-crunched public sector and looming changes to Medicaid under the new federal health care law. HRSA, the Federal Health Resources and Service Administration, is expected next year to release a system for measuring the performance of community paramedics, which could, for the first time, standardize training and create a system that would be able to function alike in rural and big cities. Working with paramedics to create a healthcare system that's focused on reducing emergencies and improving safety, now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.